Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we are pleased to have as our guest, Cree Lefevre, author of Private Means, just released by Grove Atlantic. Cree is the author of Lights On, Rats Out, and several cookbooks, including the James Beard Award-nominated Fish. So, Memorial Day weekend, Alice and Peter have misplaced their dog, Maybelle. She's lost. Peter, who is not as bereft as Alice and eager to get away from a stale marriage, heads to the Berkshires. Alice nails missing posters to telephone poles and attends a support group for rich people with missing expensive dogs who command substantial stud fees. An interesting and exciting thing happens at this party, and it leads to a sea change in the marriage. Alice studies murmurations and starlings, something I hope we'll have a chance to delve into today. And Peter is a psychiatrist who is dramatically attracted to one of his patients. Actually, so am I. By Labor Day, a transformation, without me giving away spoilers, has occurred. It's a book that is in part about summer in the city and elsewhere, as well as money, or the lack thereof, and loss. It's funny and sad, and those are cool kinds of books. And it may strike home, for good or for bad, with many of us for many reasons. So with that, welcome, Cree, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Sam, thanks so for having me. It was a really wonderful introduction. I love the way you've set up the book. I really do. Thank you.
You're welcome. So first thing, I guess you like wine.
You know, on rereading the book, you know, it's hardcover, I was struck by just how much wine is going on in this book. Yes, indeed.
Well, the thing about it is when you read on an iPad, I can ask how many times you've used a word.
Oh dear.
So wine is 44, and there's another one. I have to think about it. But wine is 44 times.
That's very funny. I'm really so thrilled to have that statistic in my head.
Sorry. I don't know if I should do that. Well, the second thing is I always like to talk about covers, and the galley I got didn't have it, but now I can see it. I can kind of show it up. It's in black and white. And the cover is so cool because it seems to represent all the elements of the book. You know, you have the Sleeping Beauty who has some flaws, like in the belly, but it's very Renaissance. And then you have the murmuration of the starlings. You have the city, you have the country, and you have the missing dog who is actually more attractive than I envisioned. And did you choose the cover? Did you get a chance to vet it? Because I never know.
Yeah, we had a go through with the cover. So if you look around, there was an early cover that was much more poppy, and I didn't love it. It was kind of a graphic of two sets of legs and a dog. And I wanted something more complicated, and I really got it with this. Grove's artist, in-house artist, Gretchen Morgenthau, put the cover together, and she was a real fan of the book and really understood all the, sort of seemed to pull together all the elements, the starlings, and actually it's Venus's like nude reclining, and that painting comes up in the conversation about analyst chairs in later or midway in the book. So she really pulled, and plus the dog, of course, and the dog is quite attractive. It's based on my own dog, and if you look at my social media, you'll see many pictures of her, and she's quite cute, I have to say.
It's funny because, you know, I own an independent bookstore, and as many times as people say you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes into my bookstore, unless they're looking for something specific, every single person judges every book by its cover.
Right.
And
yeah,
I can't help it. And this is a great cover. Yeah, because usually when they put a woman on the cover, for some reason now they cut off a part of her, whether it's the head. And, you know, I don't want to use the phrase chick books, but they do. And this doesn't look like that. It looks like much more of I don't want to say not accessible, but it looks more like a dramatic and intelligent read than some beach read.
That's what I wanted. I did really want that. Like, I wanted the complicated layers in there as opposed to just a quick sort of chirpy beach read-y look. And, you know, at the same time, I do want the book to feel appealing and accessible. So I hope it sort of draws the people to it without intimidating, you know, yeah. But I didn't want to dumb it down too much. So I'm really, really happy with the cover. I think it's really beautiful.
Well, now that we're open again, we just opened for 4 days a week, but we're doing really well.
Oh, that's so great.
So it's on the front table, and you can tell when people walk by because I look around for sure, and I make sure that I'm not, if a book is good and has a bad cover, it's still going to be there. But I like to make sure there are good-looking covers on there, mm-hmm. and it definitely makes a difference.
Good.
But be that as it may, I'm trying to sell your book. Well, actually, that helped.
Thank you.
So have you ever lost a dog? Because I have, and I know what it feels like.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry you've lost a dog, because I can't. The reason I put the lost dog in, well, there's a lot of reasons, because I'm very attached to my dog in some of the same ways that Alice, my main character, or one of the two main characters, is attached to her dog. But I kept seeing these posters in New York City for lost dogs. And often they're small dogs, maybe just because a lot of New Yorkers own small dogs, or maybe because small dogs get lost more often. I don't really know. And it was just devastating. I just put myself in that place, or tried to. It just felt like the most awful place to go, because I adore my dogs so much. And I think we all do. We all love our dogs so much.
It is interesting. It's not like you love them more than your kids or something, but there is something, because it's unconditional, you know?
I think that's right. And I have tried to think it through. I think the unconditional, unspeaking quality of our pets makes them sort of vessels for us. I talk about Alice's would sort of console the dog when she's upset, and talk to it like, oh, it's okay, as if somehow the dog's upset, which of course the dog probably is somewhat upset because its owner's upset, but there's something that you projecting in a way about having a pet. They seem to just contain our feelings, I guess.
But it is funny though, like if you lose a cat, it's basically like the cat is saying, you know, okay, I've had enough, you know, I really don't need you.
I'm done with you. Yeah. Whereas a dog, it's like,
right, the dog's going,
awful has probably happened to your dog. Yeah.
Well, it's like that New Yorker cartoon where the dog is sitting by the front door and the master finally walks in and the dog goes, where were you? I was worried about you.
No, exactly. And you're not going to get that from a cat. That's for sure.
No. No. Cat would be like, okay.
Having said that, I do adore cats, but still.
I have both.
Yeah.
Well, so I've watched some of the videos of yours, especially the COVID one in which you're with your husband being interviewed. And I know you've been married happily for over 25 years to Dwight, who's also a renowned book critic at the New York Times. And has he kind of reviewed your book anywhere other than that in that talk?
No. He would definitely not be allowed to do that.
Right.
Certainly not in the Times. He can't even get near it in the Times, of course.
True.
But, you know, I'm really careful with my work. If you watch that, I think we talked probably about this. It's not the easiest thing to be a writer married to a book critic, because he's a tough, tough reader. As anyone who's been harshly reviewed or kindly reviewed, you know, he doesn't sort of hold back. And I can tell when my husband likes or doesn't like something, whether or not he's trying to say something different. So when I first had him read this book, which was after my agent had accepted it, because I trust my agent first, and I was thrilled that he liked it. Not to mention the fact that, you know, it isn't based on our marriage, but our marriage has, you know, some percentage overlap with this, because of course I'm a human being who draws on my own experience. So there were other many other reasons why he might not have liked the book, other than literary ones. So he loved it, and I was really, really thrilled.
Well, I don't want to make this about him, and I know he has different and more important characteristics, but in researching for you, I found him. But then I was, and then I found that he was a proud member of the Organ Meat Society.
Oh.
And then I went to then I was supposed to be working on your book, and then I started going off on that and the colorectal. It just was.
Well, Sam, I hope you'll have him on. He has a book coming out actually in November, a wonderful book of quotations. It's pretty terrific. It's the commonplace book for grownups. It's you know, rude in all the ways you want it to be rude and harsh, and it's wonderful. And it reads like a prose poem because it's not categorized. I am also a member of the Organ Meat Society.
Oh, God.
And it is a terrific group of people. The wonderful Dan Okrent started it with some other people, and I am honored but it's another casualty of COVID, I have to say right now, which is very sad.
The brain cream sauce is what got to me.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think I was invited, Sam, because I served a sheep's head for my dinner guests, one of which was some of the members. So that got me through the door.
Okay, let's go back to your book.
Okay.
So, well, I can tie it into your marriage and you saying there were some parallels, overlaps. So how did you, with your experience of this over 25 years of what seems to be a really stable and happy marriage, how did you envision and then portray on paper a marriage that was kind of depressing, such as Alice's and Peter's? Did you like look at your other friends who are couples, not to give away anything?
I did a fair amount of that. I looked around. The marriage in the book is I think the book is somewhat of a satire. You don't see it that way. I think I'm satirical. There's some satirical humor. Let's put it that way.
There's definitely, that's why I said at the beginning, there's definitely humor. And then there's like,
yeah.
And then you think, why am I laughing? But then you realize it really is funny. And that's why I said it's cool. Because I like when readers have to like kind of guess or think
right.
about it. Yeah.
So our marriage definitely went through a dark period. So some of what I'm drawing on is actually from personal experience. I think when the nest empties is a very tough time for couples.
Yes.
It's a big transition, and we worked hard and we hated each other for about a year. Slightly before the nest emptied. I don't know. There's a transitional moment in there for people who have children, who when the kids start closing their doors and all of a sudden you're looking across the room at the person or the dinner table at the person you're about to spend the next, whatever, 30, 40 years with, just the two of you again, after 20 years of having kids around. It's pretty shocking. And I think people, you know, we have to make decisions about how we want to live our lives. And by that point, our lives are so enmeshed with each other, not just children, but like pets and family and house and mortgages and finances. And it just feel it. I was really curious about that moment. And in my friends' marriages as well, where there's the opportunity to break free, but most people are not going to take that risky chance. And then I wondered, what makes a marriage really sticky in a good way versus in a bad way? Like, well, some people just stay because they're scared to leave, and some people stay because they find what they're looking for in their marriage instead of outside of it.
I always find that everybody pretty much does the best they can, even if it sucks, you know?
I agree with that.
The other thing is that, you know, and tell me if I'm giving too much away, you know, they get to the point where they have separate bedrooms. And like you were saying about the kids, Alice closes the door, and he knows, okay, that's sacrosanct. But then the idea, which I preclude my children from doing, is that they call each other or text each other within the confines of the house. It drives me crazy. I said, Annie, come in. If you want to talk to me, come in here. Do not text me.
I love it that you do that. So you know what? I'm going to fess up right here. You know, my husband and I will actually text each other from the other room, but it's kind of flirty. It's actually flirty instead of like, I don't see it as a bad thing. I don't know. I also do hate yelling in a house. There's nothing worse than someone yelling upstairs or downstairs, right? I would prefer a text to the yell downstairs. But yes, you're not giving too much away to say that they have separate bedrooms. And I actually am going to defend separate bedrooms for couples because honestly, what is nicer than your own bed? I mean, I know a lot of people really love to snuggle and they love to, and I think it's important. And this isn't even about sex. This is about sleeping. I mean, there are many reasons to advocate single beds or separate beds for couples. And I know lots of couples who have separate beds, maybe in the same room, but whatever. Space is a big thing.
Oh, yeah. Even the difference between a queen and a king, which my partner and I have discussed, which I guess I better not talk about.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to get in trouble here, too. So let's not talk about those things.
So I really like, since what you really are, well, no, now you're this, but what you really, your first love is cooking. And so I really like the scenes, even though they weren't cooking, but I love the scenes when the New York service, which we don't have in Philadelphia, what's it called again? Not Grubhub or what's it?
Oh God, it's been so long since I've used it.
I can't believe you can't remember your own book.
I know.
I can almost wait. I know how I can look it up. I can look up the word dino. That'll do.
Dino,
it.
Which is dinosaur barbecue. Which
well,
is
see, that's where I thought, okay, the relationship is kind of good because it's Chinese and he goes dino, and I'm thinking, okay, that's something. And then I loved when they were eating the ribs, I got hungry. And when they were eating the Chinese food, I got hungry too. Barbecue, so.
Oh, okay, I could think of it. It's funny, because I want to think street easy, because we were trying to think about where we're moving next, and that's not it. Oh God. All right, if we leave it, I'll remember.
Yeah, I know. He goes, dono, Chinese barbecue. And he says, dino. But then it says, I like the way you do how many minutes out they are, because I do that too. And that's really silly also. But everyone does it.
But everyone does it. And I really, I think that one of the things about the book or about my desire in writing this book was just documenting those little tiny minutiae, the minutiae of our daily lives, because when I see that reflected on the page back to me, that sort of thrill of recognition, or I don't know, there's something about domestic fiction, really, which is what this kind of is, in an old school kind of Austin sense, that I like all those little details of like where people are sleeping and what they're eating and what they do behind closed doors and how they communicate. That's domestic fiction. That's
the way she waters her plants, which kind of gets Peter a little upset. Actually, the plants and the dog are part of the problem with the marriage, because he's kind of thinking, wait a minute, what am I, chopped liver? No pun intended.
Exactly. And he's like, she lavishes this attention on her plants and her dog with attention, like just great care. And he's sitting over here wondering where the affection is. So he's kind of wondering where else he can find some love a little bit, right? I mean, the guy's human. I mean, she's a bit of a cold character for some people. I don't know if you found her cold, but some people find her not super likable.
She has this tendency to criticize herself, especially with regard to her body and her age. Mm-hmm. And so she does the same thing to herself in a lot of ways.
That's true.
Hey, you know what? George has really white teeth. And both Peter and Alice admire, and this is not a spoiler, but I can say it, both Peter and Alice admire, and the first time they see them and long for them in different ways, completely different ways. But
I just, you know, don't you know those people though that have the most perfect white teeth, and they've clearly had them like worked on and bleached, and it's very expensive, and you know, it's such an American like fetish that we have with our perfect teeth, but it's increasingly a sign of wealth and access. You know, it really is like, it's a, you don't have good teeth, it says something about your socioeconomic status, and that is not a good thing. I mean, it's just, ugh.
Yeah, well, that's what was so funny about the lost dog support group. And George was there. But they, you know, it wasn't really about the dogs. It was about the serving ladies and how they were dressed and the food and the stud fees and all that. It wasn't about the dog. It was about them. And yeah, it was, that was hilarious. And I'm wondering, does that, do you think that really happens?
I've not been to a lost dog meeting, but I've been to people's apartments that were so stunning and filled with such incredible art and were staffed with people to wait on the guests in a way that just blows my mind. I mean, blows my mind. The level of privilege, as we all know, in this country on different levels, if you even touch the bottom rungs of that well, it's stunner.
Yeah, it's like when you watch or read about the Met Gala every year.
Yeah.
And like 150,000. I don't want to see Kanye West wearing some. I don't want to see any of that.
I don't want to see any of it. I mean, I want it's to horrible. See it in a way just to be more disgusted and more repulsed. But I don't want to emulate. I don't want to be that. I want to look at it and think about, how did we get here, right? I mean, right. How do we get to the point where we value these things so much?
Right. And the money they spend, as much many causes as they have, all that money could feed, could clothe.
Yeah.
And it's never thought of. And that's why Democrats have problems.
That's right.
One of the reasons.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons.
So, yeah, anyway, Lisbeth, as things went on, I was more and more attracted to her.
And, I love it. I love look. It, Sam, that you're attracted to her. That makes me so happy.
Well, she kept wearing more and more diaphanous outfits.
She can't help it, right? She's slinking into her shrink's office trying to seduce him as subtly as possible, right?
Yeah, and like, I mean, I've been in therapy with both female and male therapists. And, you know, I read statistics about the number, the percentage that have relationships with their patients, and it's an enormous number. And I don't know.
Very bad thing. I mean, I've done a ton of therapy. And if anyone's read my book, Lights On, Rats Out, they will know that I was in love with my shrink in my 20s, crazy in love with him. And it was really, excuse me, it was really hard. And you're supposed to be in love with your shrink a little bit. And the shrink is supposed to handle that in a way that allows you to feel those feelings, but then move on from them. So it's really complicated when the shrink is having some conflicted response to the patient. I don't know if you ever felt that in your therapeutic relationships, but it's not the way it's supposed to go.
No, and you know, you can call it the transference because, yeah, my therapist had become my father, my mother, my whatever. It just... And that actually shows that it's kind of working.
Exactly.
But he hasn't had sex in 2 years, and you very casually kind of intimate that he's also on the computer doing certain things. So he's kind of like, and that's why when he goes to a supervising therapist and they talk about the cornice, that was one of the most important parts of the book to me.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it. I really appreciate you picking out that scene, because I feel like that's the kind of conversation a supervising shrink might have with their sort of junior or their former student in a way. And, you know, as the cornice, of course, is a situation where they're talking about the cornice breaking and him being on the bridge of an sort of avalanche, which is a cornice can become an avalanche very easily with just the slightest movement of some part of the structure. And of course, that metaphor is playing throughout the book in terms of the murmurations and the movement of all kinds of substances, whether it's fluid or cars or birds or information or just general sort of energy between people in a city. So in other words, that sort of chaos, which we think of as chaos, but it's actually sort of thermodynamic flow. It's actually this controlled flow. As anyone who knows probably more than I do about chaos, it's not really chaos, right? It's an actual movement that is controlled by very complicated factors. So in other words, like traffic flow, we're all familiar with that. So the cornice, the avalanche, just once it happens, it's gonna just, it occurs and there's no stopping it. And it is incredibly powerful. And I think that's the thing about that as a metaphor, that once something has a certain kind of momentum, it's so difficult to, you can't stop it. Like you're sort of with it. And I guess Peter's a little afraid that he's already going down this sort of bad path toward transgressing certain boundaries with his young patient, Lisbeth.
Yeah, it's funny the way you mentioned that because, well, real quick, he gets stuck in traffic. She's watching traffic. And it's, you know, so all these things kind of like, you know, at first I was thinking, well, what does one have to do with the other? And then all of a sudden, oh, yeah. Well, and the white teeth, you know, and they do. And it's like right now, Hurricane Laura, which the weather can't. They're really happy because they get upset when it's only a category one, but now it's going to be a category four. They're like all hump.
Already. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This thing is doing exactly what we're talking about. You look at the flow. It's incredible. The energy that's in it and that gets generated and it pulls from around it. I think that's what's the most fascinating part of all these kind of movements. So in terms of the starling, so Alice, I know you wanted to get to this, so I'm going to jump in there. Alice studies murmurations of starlings, which are those wonderful formations of fluid formations you see of large flocks of birds. And starlings aren't the only birds that do it, but they're the most common birds. And because there are literally millions of starling, I mean, there are more than that probably. I don't know what the starling population of the world is, but they're sort of a pest bird because they thrive almost everywhere and they form these, they look really kind of supernatural. Have you seen one, Sam?
Well, after I read the book, I went to YouTube and I watched them and I just sent them to my partner and she's like, and she just texted me back. She just said, that's so beautiful and so haunting.
Beautiful.
And the thing about it is at my house, which was built in 1775, we have this gigantic cucumber magnolia in the front yard.
Wow.
And if you go out certain times of the year in the early morning and you clap your hands like that, they all just go.
Oh, wow. Cool.
It's one of the coolest things ever.
It is so cool. I just could just watch those things all day. And I've seen some in person, not in any of the locations that I mentioned in the book, but we used to live in New Jersey and the starlings would settle over the cut cornfield and then they would pull up, you know, at a disturbance of some kind. And I talk a little bit about this, something that disturbs them, something that puts them into that motion, whatever it is that propels the cornice to become an avalanche or the starlings to take flight and form is, you know, hard to know. It's often a predator though, with starlings.
And that's how they perceive. It's really interesting when I watch the YouTube, there's always one guy who's not in sync. And that's, I would like to be that one guy.
It would be cool, right? I wonder what's up with the one bird that's like not following the formation in any way. I mean, I sort of get into why, so as far as my understanding, and I worked pretty hard to understand the science of this, there isn't a complete understanding of what the communication mechanism is between the birds that keeps them in such perfect formation, because it's a very rapid, it's not like geese flying in a V. That's quite simple This is, as you saw, you know, it's multidimensional and it looks like a fluid. The way it looks like coffee going into cream if it's swirling, right? Sometimes like that movement is very dynamic.
Yeah, you call it, or I call it, I think it's either called liquid smoke or gas.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing that's really interesting, and then you really can tie it in, I can't actually articulate why, but the first meeting between George and Alice where they share, you know, it's like one of those meetings, it's like one of those dinners on the first date where you go, you like oranges? I like oranges too. You know, it's like... But they talk to each other and they understand each other while this full-breasted bartender is leaning over.
Right.
Which is, that's really funny too. But
haven't you been in that situation where the bartender's trying to hit on your date or whatever? And you're just like, I'm here too. And then she's so happy because he doesn't care about this nubile young bartender with the great breasts that are like spilling over the bar. And Alice is so pleased that he only has eyes for her. So.
Yeah, like when you say no-go.
Yeah, no-go, exactly.
But it's like, you know, they're talking about these things that really interest me because it's the science of it, especially at the quantum level. You say there's one thing where you say phase transitions, which they're both talking about, one with regard to the birds, one with regard to bacteria. You know, and you go, is there collective action inherent in matter itself? And I've always wondered about that. And I've talked, a lot of my interviews are with scientists who talk about consciousness. So collective action, you know, whether it's a rock or a galaxy,
yep.
You know, all these things change over time. And then when you look at the birds, you're thinking, well, how do they do that? Why do they do that?
Right.
And you ask that question. And then, okay, I'll give the title of your article, Alice's article for Quanta, Flight by Sight, Pixelated Hyperuniformity, Sternus vulgaris and murmurations as expressions of hydrodynamic chaos. And as you said earlier in the interview, it's not really chaos, at least in your mind.
Right. No. Yeah. I mean, on the quantum level, that's where this goes pretty quickly. And I am super underqualified to really even talk about this. But the more I learned, the more fascinating it was. And in some senses, you do come to the conclusion that it is sort of like that there is some energy inherent in matter itself. And it seems like, I don't know, I'm not sure I should even delve into all this right now, especially if you sound like you know quite a lot about it because you do interview scientists. Everything I learned in the process of writing this book and trying to understand the dynamics and the, on the quantum level of what, I mean, that's really where the researcher seems to have gone, and which is, yeah. And it's also what Alice is trying to play catch up on a little bit, because when she left the field, when she had her children, you know, 18 years prior or whatever, it wasn't all about quantum physics at that point. It was more about being a biologist in the field and going and looking at the birds and studying their behavior and that kind of thing, and trying to figure out the answer to these formations by studying nature. And the field shifted so dramatically just in the time she was away that she's trying to play catch up.
There's one part of the book, you might get mad at me, but it's like when you say when they're having sex, I just said they, and you talk about sweat, semen, saliva, and other unknowable and unnameable bodily fluids. And I know them all because of some weird ass biology teacher I had.
Oh, that's great.
So you have bile, blood, menstrual fluid, mucus, pus, tears, urine, and vomit. And so when you say unknowable and unnameable, I'm going like, oh.
Well, no, they aren't. They actually aren't. Sam, I love it. I should have put that in the paren somehow.
It goes back into the organ meats.
Yes, it does. Did you have sweat in that list?
You did.
I have sweat.
You have sweat, semen, saliva, and then they're unnameable. And then.
Oh, yeah.
But that's Alice. That's just Alice. I mean, that's just Alice.
Yeah. And she's being kind of a, she's being, I mean, Alice is also, I mean, Peter hasn't had sex in 2 years and Alice hasn't had sex in 2 years. So I don't want to give away who actually ends up having that semen, all that excitement. But, you know, when I think that we live in an age of less sex for some people, or maybe it's just older people. I don't know. We have the internet. We have, as I say, I think maybe twice in the book or two different characters say sex is so 20th century. So in other words, the physicality of two people having sex. I mean, you could argue, of course, with all these sort of apps and various ways pre-COVID of ways of hooking up that sex is very much 21st century. But I don't know. I don't know. It just struck me as, you know, I think there's a fair amount of masturbation as opposed to sex in the book.
And that's, you know, essentially masturbation doesn't really accomplish anything. There's no downside to it really, but there's no upside to it really.
Right.
Which is where the term mental masturbation came up. It doesn't really get you anywhere in terms of your life goals, but it feels good for a moment.
Right, right.
And it's funny too, because in addition to them not having sex for 2 years, they both independently think, and when we did have it, it kind of sucked.
Yeah, it's not very nice, is it?
No.
I mean, I think they both harken back to their very early days of having sex when it really was good. But for a while before they stop having sex, it's been like, you know, and it, you know, I think I describe it as sort of, you know, them trying to achieve this sort of ideal of good sex. Like, what does that mean? You know, we've got this sort of notion, this idealized version in all of our heads of what good sex is. And I think that the porn industry has really changed, for some people anyway, what that means and what that looks like and what that involves. So I think we're in a weird spot with sex in some ways, because I don't know. I mean,
well, yeah, it's like Facebook having you identify as 20 different genders.
Yeah.
I don't want to be called cisgender because it sounds like I'm a sissy, but all it means is that I'm regular.
Right. Yeah. Oh, you're going to get in trouble for that, Sam.
Oh, I know. I can't. I mean, it's so silly. I mean, now Woman, you can't do woman. You have to do Wom X. You know, give me a break. You know, it's just, okay, I get it. You don't want to be like a man or be dependent, but you know, it's a word. That's all.
It's a word. And it does have meaning still. And you know, and all our words are evolving, I guess, very, very rapidly. And you know.
Yeah. I feel sorry for JK Rowling because she went through so much she didn't really do anything. Just a couple of tweets, you know?
Yeah.
It
strikes me as a real overreaction. Definitely.
Yeah. It's like, you know, well, so talking about the internet in the 21st century, well, there's two things. Well, before that, there was one thing that confused me. When they go to their friend's house, which is gradually receding and falling apart, there's a part where they run. Well, first of all, Peter loves the water, and I like that. And I like the way he goes swimming with his kids for hours, and no matter how fetid or murky the water is. But the part where they go running into the water, the two of them, Alice and Peter, giggling, I couldn't tell whether it was happening then or happening when one of their prior trips. I was thinking, okay.
Oh, yeah, no. I don't have the book in front of me, but my point there was, I think Alice says something like, you know, she felt the burden of sort of making it fun with Peter in the absence of the girls who normally would have been there, but were, you know, away for the first time during the summer because they're out west doing their internship. So I think that the point there was Alice. Yeah, I think it was it would have been in the past. So everyone running and giggling, everyone feeling, but I think that, so, ooh, I don't know. I have to look at the passage, but, you know, the goal was to think about the ways that Alice suddenly was trying to reconfigure their relationship as just the two of them And were they going to have a future of stopping at the clam shack and fighting, or are they going to have a future together that looked like the two of them enjoying each other's company, just the two of them, whether it's going swimming or stopping the clam shack on the way up the coast, you know? So,
And I like the way every once in a while your hat as a chef comes out, like when they're talking about which is the best oysters, which are the best oysters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it doesn't have to be in there, but it's good that it's in there. But it wouldn't be in there if it wasn't something that you were an expert in.
I'm surprised by how much food I snuck in the book, actually. Again, it was between the wine and the food. I was reading it again. And I realized that it's really part of my DNA. You know, my dad was a chef, and I just grew up in a really food centric, wine centric universe. My dad had me, you know, tasting wine when I was really young, like 9. You know, just like, have one little sip of this, what do you taste, kind of thing. And, you know, kids
That's
are going
great.
To get that now, but I'm just like, I'm a lot older than other people. So in other words, I was doing that in the 60s and 70s. We were traveling to Europe and eating in, you know, 3-star restaurants and really fancy exotic experience. You know, we were on bikes, to be fair, but still. So I had a very privileged childhood in a lot of ways in terms of travel and food and experiences. My parents were the kind of people that valued that over pretty much everything else. Like, we didn't drive fancy cars, we didn't have a swimming pool. Well, anyway, so you know, I guess it's just part of me, food and wine.
And the only time you got kind of snobby is when you said, I can't, drinking the cab after May, you know, it's like.
Doing what?
The Cabernet.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got snotty there, and I got snarky about, so this is one of the reasons that I'm so glad I'm not writing food books anymore, because, I mean, not to just say I don't want to do it again at some point, but I really, I'm a little saturated with our food culture right now. I think it's really kind of overwrought and over sort of worked. So that moment where they're at Philo Farms in Vermont, which is the pizzeria when they go see Peter's parents. And, you know, that kind of preciousness about food and every single ingredient. And I find it just tiresome, like really tiresome. I mean, I shop at farmers markets, and I appreciate all the farmers who are doing hard work, and I understand they have to charge more, and they want to, and I believe in heirloom seeds and chickens, but I really don't want to talk about it all day long, and I don't want to hear about it all day either.
Yeah, when you talked about the price of lobster rolls, I realized I feel exactly the same way. You know, how do you charge $25 for a lobster roll? Seriously.
You know what, Sam? My daughter just went, was in Maine yesterday. She bought a $27 lobster roll. She split it with her boyfriend. But still, I mean, since when does a lobster roll cost $27?
I was in Maine and exactly the same thing happened. And you don't know how bitchy,
I can get bitchy too.
But, you know, it's funny. My daughter, you're talking about 3 stars. I took her to Italy last year, and all she did was look up the 3-star Michelin restaurants. And I said, Annie, you know, I can't really afford to continue to take you to these places.
That's great.
But she was so excited because she's 19 and she could drink there.
Oh,
but
yeah.
All she ended up liking was Prosecco. And so sometimes I would be tired, but she would still go down to the little happy hour that they had at the and just I'd come down and there's these flute glasses and there's Annie eating hors d'oeuvres and drinking Prosecco.
I love it that you guys did that. I mean, there's nothing like, my kids both managed to get to Europe before they were 21 too, and both of them actually study abroad, and it's such a great experience.
Oh,
because 21 is a stupid age to be able to drink. It's a stupid age.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Plus, I took her, not that I wanted to go because I'm not, but I took her to a cooking class. And she was cooking pasta, and she was done. All the people at the cooking class applaud it, and they go, wow, I can't believe she's so good. And she's 19, but she's a little tiny. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And she was so happy that I had done that. So it was well worth it.
That's so great.
That's not selling your book either. That's the problem with me being an interviewer. I end up doing these things and I forget, especially like when we talk about the book.
Yeah.
I forget that the people who haven't read it, because it just came out, especially now with COVID, I'm telling them, I'm talking to you about things that they don't know anything about.
I know, it's really hard. I've really tried to train myself about spoiler alerts too, because I want to talk about the whole book because it's so much fun just to talk about the book and talk about each scene and be like, oh my God, I can't believe so-and-so did this or this plot point or whatever. And I realized that that's really not, it's not helpful to people who, because I actually, you know, I just did a piece about being a rereader. So I don't really care that much about plot. But when I'm reading a book for the first time, I don't really want to know what's going to happen, you know.
Yeah, I know. And yeah, so it's okay if I talk about Cornus because it doesn't really give anything away.
No one has any idea what, yeah.
But if I go any further on George or, I won't. So.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, you know, what do you think? I'm not sure how much it really matters. I mean, I guess it matters. I guess it matters. Yeah.
Well, like, I mean, if you go on Good Morning America or whatever it is called now, or you go on Stephen Colbert or Terry Gross, who I have issues with, because they're all softball questions. But like the first question is, so what's your book about? And I've never asked that.
I mean, I guess it's because they have not read the book.
Right.
I mean, Terry Gross claims to have read what she does, I think. I don't know if she actually does. Or her producers and helpers tell her enough, but.
I mean, I have to read it. I mean, the thing is, you know, I can brag and say I graduated college with high honors in English literature, but it was easy. You read the book, then you take the test, and you, since you've read the book, you know all the answers, and all my friends are reading Cliff Notes. And I'm going, well, just, Nick, you can just read the book.
You can just read the actual book. I know, I agree. Every English class I took, it's like, this is really easy because all you have to do is be able to write about what you've read or think about what you've read. So I think this is what I like.
Yeah, I mean, even if it's poetry and you're reading Cristobal by Coleridge, I mean, yeah, you got to think a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then when you figure it out, it's like, wow, that's really cool. It's wonderful, scary, but wonderful. Or even like Tristram Shandy, where he doesn't get born until like 150 pages into the book. I mean, but that kind of stuff, you know, it's great if you're that kind of person.
Yeah.
And so it was easy. So my father was very proud of me and all that kind of stuff. But it was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It's wasn't that hard, Dad.
It's not that hard. Yeah. Anyway, you're in the right business, clearly. Books are.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is, you know, you can't make, you know, anytime you read a story where a bookseller says he's making a fortune or a lot of money, he's lying because you cannot do that. You can have a bookstore and you can tread water and you can get by, but especially now, although, like I said, we're doing as well or better now simply because when people don't know what they do, they want to go to a bookstore.
And yeah, do you feel like people are reading more? I do feel like people are reading more during this pandemic. I think that initially, and you can tell me if I'm right about this, they were reading stuff that they had neglected to read, like sort of the big titles that they sort of hadn't covered yet and had meant to read. But maybe now they're through those titles and they're trying to find some more stuff to read. I don't know. What do you think?
Definitely. And there's more classics and a lot of the books that were scheduled to come out, just like movies, they pushed. And for Christmas time, it's really hard for me to order because I don't know, am I ordering too many? And I'm kind of almost already too late for Christmas. But
I am.
I mean, yeah, especially for retail stuff.
Wow.
But, and what the hell happened to this year? I'm old.
I think along with everyone else, aren't we all glad for 2020 to be over soon?
Yeah, but I didn't even have it.
I know. It's strange.
There's part, I mean, it's changed a lot of things and it's not going to change back. People have definitely become different types of people, but going back to your book again. And we can end here too. The thing that I really took away from this is that, as I said at the beginning, I'm saying, you know, it's like a book that has chapters and each chapter is a different person and you find you like one and you go to the next. I don't want to read about her. Right? I want to go back to this person.
Right. I do hate that. Sometimes I'm just like, no, don't. I don't like this character. Give me that other one.
Yeah. So you just kind of go through it. But no, so what I was equating that to in your book is at the beginning, there's all these disparate elements that are really not connectable, whether it's the water, whether it's swimming, whether it's the food, whether it's the murmurations, whether it's the plants, whether it's the dog, which is, you know, it's really about the dog. I mean, that's how you started. It's all about the dog.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, so what I'm getting at is then they all come together and you don't, it's like transparent. You don't know that they're coming together. And that's what's so cool about it.
Well, that's the biggest compliment that anyone's given me about this book, because I really appreciate that. I mean, that is the goal, right? As a novelist, you're trying to throw this stuff up in the air, all these different elements that are really complicated, but they feel connected. And fiction does that for us sometimes. It enables us to see the bigger picture when we can't always see it ourselves in our own lives or in our own little ways. So that I appreciate that a great deal.
Yeah, it's you know, to go from the murmurations to a stale marriage and then have the reader understand why that happened. Yeah, that's the goal of a good author. I agree. So with that, I'll do the Terry Gross thing. We've been talking to Cree Lefevre, author of Private Means, which was published earlier this month by Grove Atlantic. Thanks so much, Cree, for joining us today. This was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me, Sam. Appreciate it.
Talk to you soon.